So if you've been here the past couple of weeks, you know we've been talking about the nature of work and talking a lot about the dignity and goodness of work, that even the most mundane job is actually partnering with God in restoring some shalom to His creation, restoring that goodness, that peace, working together to rearrange the basic resources of life so that life here can flourish and drawing out potential out of the world so that life can thrive. We've talked about how there really is no secular sacred distinction, at least not from a biblical worldview, that that donning the McDonald's uniform there is no less sacred a calling than being a missionary to Africa, for instance. That radical discipleship, radically following Jesus, just might mean tomorrow morning getting up and going to work with competence and enthusiasm. Restoring shalom, restoring that order that God created into that area of the world He has called you to. We talked about the fact that your job is holy. It's a calling. It's a sacred vocation. It has nobility. It has dignity. Whatever your job might be. It's how God created things. And after a couple of weeks, you may be thinking, okay, whatever, right? Like, okay, this just kind of proves it, Pastor, you're kind of clueless because this isn't at all describing my job. Maybe you feel like that sometimes you feel like your job is more like just running on a hamster wheel. You're not going anywhere. Or you come home and you turn to the newspaper and to the comics and you think, Dilbert, you have it so good, right? What's all this talk about nobility and calling and sacred vocation and stuff? No, my job just saps the life out of me. That's all my job's about. And we all know something of that experience to some extent or another. We all know there's truth in that, isn't there? I mean, there are times when we experience the curse of Genesis chapter 3. And we can't speak honestly about work, about our calling, about our vocation, unless we speak honestly as well about the fruitlessness and the meaninglessness that sometimes goes along with our work. So that's what I'd like to do this morning, looking at a couple of passages beginning in chapter 3 of Genesis that we read. It's the story of the fall. After God had created everything, He created this fantastic universe and created people with whom to partner in shaping this good universe into a hospitable place where life can thrive and flourish, and then sin enters the world. We call that the fall. The fall. And the fall was more than just one isolated event of disobedience and rebellion. The fall was a catastrophic event, significant for the entire creation. The effects of sin touch and affect all aspects of creation. Social structures, family, cultural pursuits, technology, art, sexuality, all areas of life are affected by sin. In the Reform kind of language, talk about total depravity. Total depravity isn't that everything is just as horrible and nasty as it possibly could be. But the idea of that term total depravity is that the pervasiveness of sin. Sin has had its effect spread through all areas of life. No area of the world or of life is exempt from the pollution and the destruction brought on by sin. And we see one of the effects of sin already in verse 16 of chapter 3, significant pain in childbearing. And there's a curse here. And it's a curse that touches the family. There's pain in that physical act of childbearing and But those of you with children know that that pain only starts with the birth. That pain associated with children's birth continues often throughout the parents' lives. Some of you know the sharp pain that comes as children who are born into sin often become a significant source of heartache in their parents' lives. As the kids experience themselves the consequences of their sin and rebellion, it tears at the parents' hearts. And that pain doesn't necessarily go away a few months after the birth. And then there's that last part of verse 16 where God says to the woman, your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Now that's kind of a sticky verse. A lot of different people have come at it from different perspectives, different interpretations. What does it mean? I find it helpful to look at another verse where that same word desire is used. What is God actually saying here to Eve? Well, in chapter 4, verse 7, we have the story of Cain and Abel. And Cain is just all ticked off at God because God doesn't like his sacrifice as much as Abel's. And so God warns Cain. He says, Cain, you be careful. You be real careful because sin is crouching at your door and it desires to have you. That same word from chapter 3:16, desire. The idea is, Cain, sin is crouching at your door and doesn't just desire to rub shoulders with you once in a while. Sin wants to dominate you. Sin seeks mastery over your life, Cain. In the same way of chapter 3:16, God warns that Eve's desire would be for her husband, not a healthy desire of mutual love, but a desire for dominance, a desire for control. And the same would also be true of the husband. He would rule over her. And so however you want to tease out the exact meaning of all those words, clearly the idea is God has created husband and wife a beautiful, healthy relationship originally where they complement one another and they live together in mutuality and trust. And now because of sin, there's a power struggle. Now there's a power struggle. Now there's misunderstanding and frustration and wrangling and backstabbing that have become the norm in so many relationships. The text goes on how sin affects life in verses 17 to 19, and it describes how sin not only affects personal and private relationships, but sin affects work as well. Toil now becomes painful toil. The fruit of your labor is not going to be so easily enjoyed. You'll have to contend with thorns and thistles. Now keep in mind, we've used that metaphor of the garden, right? That as a metaphor for all of work. That just as a person tending a garden takes that which is there and plants and arranges and moves and works those things to draw out beauty and the crops. And it's the same as work. Work, we arrange and we take the natural resources and we take that which is given and move it and shape it and bring out, draw out the potential and the beauty to help life flourish. But these verses indicate that all of work is going to be marred by thorns and thistles, by a cursed ground. The all too common reality is that we go to work and we pour out enormous energy, the sweat of our brow, and there's nothing but thorns and thistles choking out that fruit. Maybe you're a teacher and you're starting to finally make great strides with that student, finally beginning to get through, and you're starting to see a flicker of light, a flicker of hope. The student is getting it. The student is finally starting to love learning and has a vision for what life could be. And then the student goes home, and through mocking and cruel words, that kid's parents just choke out anything positive that might be starting to grow there. Or maybe you start work at a new organization and you're excited to make a real contribution to this organization. But there is somebody there who's just always seems to be just sowing these seeds of negativity and fault finding. And so nobody's really all that excited anymore about sticking their neck out and trying something new and creative. It's not worth it. And so risk-taking and creativity is just choked out. Nothing new happens, which gives even more apparent reason for negativity. And it just becomes a downward cycle, spiral. Or you think of how much time and energy go into compliance with government regulations or paperwork. Paperwork that nobody's ever going to see. But it's got to be done. It's the law. And so more and more you sense these resources being siphoned away from the real work that could be happening, that could be helping people. I think every one of us can look at our job and we see this maddening encroachment of thorns and thistles that ever diminishing our ability to do work with fruitfulness. I mean, that's the current reality of our fallen condition. We deal with fruitlessness. And this is so common in the work that we face that it can lead to a sense of meaninglessness. It's like, why bother? Why even try? I hated life because of the work that's been done under the sun. It was grievous to me. All of it's meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Why bother? What's the point? Work just seems pointless. You know, sometimes this meaninglessness is just built into our work. I mean, think about it. For centuries, people would work hard and they would work the land and working, I mean, back-breaking work, working with the thorns and the thistles. But it was okay because they could see the result of their work. They could see how the work that they did directly sustained their lives. And so there was meaning to it. But now, somebody in a factory, as a piece of urethane mold comes by on the assembly line, their job is to just attach a metal spring one after another, after another, after another, as it rolls by. And they work for GE, so they don't even know what they're making. It could be a medical part, it could be a jet engine, it could be a piece of a dishwasher, it could be a part of a light bulb. They don't know. It's just mindless, mind-numbing work. It seems so meaningless. You have no idea what you're actually doing. Or there's the high-ranking executive who feels that work is meaningless because they're trapped. They're trapped between government regulations, the stockholders, the board of directors, the unions. And trapped is a good word because nudging the system just too much anyway just creates a tremendous amount of hassle. There's so many competing interests that the executive has to pacify. So she really has a hard time answering that question. What is your job for? A couple of years ago, somebody built this machine. It was called a minimum wage machine. And the idea of this machine was you turn the crank and a penny would be dispensed every 4.97 seconds. And as you keep turning the crank, you eventually make $7.25 an hour. And that was minimum wage in New York at the time. And the idea behind this, of course, is that people would walk to it, up to it and be kind of excited. Yeah, free money. And they start cranking. But it doesn't take long before the excitement wears off and they become disheartened and they stop cranking, realizing just how little money they're actually making. It was meant to be an argument for raising the minimum wage. Now, I don't want to get in a debate on what the minimum wage should be or shouldn't be, or even if there should be a minimum wage or shouldn't be a minimum wage altogether. But I wonder if the minimum wage machine actually shows something different. Because think about this. How much money do we pay the volunteers who work with the children for homework help at the Learning Center? How much money do we pay the Sunday school teachers who teach here every week, who teach our kids? We teach them, or we pay them nothing, right? Yet week after week, day after day, these people give a significant amount of time and effort. Why? Well, it's because nothing is more satisfying than knowing you're making a difference. You're contributing in a meaningful way. Lives are changing. Things are happening. It's a good thing, and you're excited, and you're glad to be a part of it. I mean, that's why people pour tremendous amounts of time and energy into what's going on here, what's going on at Grace Clinic and other places. It's my contention that minimum wage machine could be spitting out nickels or even dimes, right? Making $70 an hour turning that crank. But the meaninglessness of just turning the crank would lead people to give up before too long. Maybe it'd take a little longer if they're making a little more money. But the meaninglessness of work is what's so discouraging. It makes it so disheartening. So what do? We have thorns, thistles, painful toil, meaninglessness, sweat of our brow. All of those things are now part of the human condition, part of our circumstances. How do we respond? What do? Well, it's important to hold intention. The Bible's teaching on creation and the fall. It's important to hold together intention. What the Bible says about the dignity and the sacredness of our calling and the fruitlessness and the meaninglessness that sometimes attaches itself to our work. To somehow hold those two together. And that's something we don't like to do. We don't like to admit it. We may even cringe at the thought of saying it out loud. And flinch because a lot of us have believed the naive message and maybe even have articulated the naive message ourselves, that you can change the world. You just grab hold of your dreams and you don't let them go, and you can be amazing. You are destined to be amazing. You are destined to change the world. I mean, there are no shortage of books at Barnes & Noble. You go there, you look at the business section, all the books about changing the world. It fits our bloated self-image, that message. But it has to be accepted. And we have to face the reality that no, you can't. No, you can't. We have to come to terms with the frustration of living and working in a world that's horribly broken. We're always going to be able to envision far more than what we'll be able to accomplish. And that's not just because of a lack of competence on our part. I mean, we can become incredibly skilled, and there's always going to be strong resistance from others and from our environment, no matter how hard we work. That's the reality of living in a world that's broken by sin. And so one of the things we have to do is just come to terms with that. Just realize that's the reality we face on Monday morning when we head to work. But there's also consolation found in knowing that this isn't the end of the story. Even when our work is profoundly frustrating, even when our work is never as fruitful as we would wish it to be, work still bears some fruit. We still have glimpses of beauty and meaning and the genius that will, by God's grace, one day be the new heavens and the new earth. Even in Genesis 3, it says that in spite of the thorns and the thistles, we will continue to eat. There will be times when God's original design for work breaks through and reminds us that He hasn't given up on His good creation. That, along with the vision of paradise in the future, that may be the only thing at times to keep us going. Christianity knows that there is a paradise coming. And there is going to be work in that paradise, just like there was work in the paradise of the past. And in this paradise in the future, the paradise that's coming, we are going to be useful and meaningful in the lives of other people to an infinite degree. And there's going to be infinite joy and satisfaction in serving one another. We're going to perform our work with all the skill that we can imagine, and with none of the thorns. The good news is that our work in this life is not the final word.